The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Gibbons presiding.
Okay, good morning, everybody. We have Justices Gibbons and Silver in Las Vegas, Justice Stiglitz in Carson City, so you may be getting questions from all of us. You can kind of look and see where they're coming from. You know, if you have any question, let me know, and thank you both for agreeing to participate here by our video system. We did it yesterday. It worked pretty well. We didn't have any audio problems at all, so we were able to get everything done. Okay, our first case is case number 75197, APCO Construction versus Zitting Brothers Construction. We have Ms. Wilde representing the appellant and Mr. Ramirez representing the respondent. Ms. Wilde, do you want to reserve some time in rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like 5 minutes, please.
You may do so. As you know the procedure very well. I haven't worked here before, but yeah, when the sound comes at 5 minutes, if you just cease speaking, then you go ahead and reserve that time then. Okay, let's go ahead. Ms. Wilde, you may proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. As noted, I'm Kathleen Wilde, and I represent the appellant, APCO, in this matter. We respectfully submit that this court should reverse and remand because the district court made multiple errors by precluding APCO's defenses and failing to hold Zitting to its burdens of proof. Moreover, the district court's decision was a disaster in that it unfairly held APCO in a position of being the guarantor of the owner's debts, even though APCO itself also lost $8 million of no fault of its own when this project collapsed. There's a lot to unpack in this case, and there's a lot of different things going on. So at the outset, is there anything that the court would like to discuss in particular, or any questions that you would like addressed?
Yeah, Ms. Wilde, I think Justice Stiglitz is going to have a couple questions on some issues here. I don't know if she wanted to wait to ask them or ask them now, but we obviously there's a lot of complex issues in this case, so we spent a lot of time on it then. Justice Stiglitz, did you want to ask? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Thank you, Chief. Ms. Wilde, I don't want to upset your plan. So, but I do want you to, when you talk about the alleged errors, I want you to also address whether or not, if this court upholds Judge Denton's decision on the sanction to preclude your defenses, if that decision is found to be correct, then necessarily did Zitting meet its burden on summary judgment? So just if you can weave that in there somewhere, that would be great.
Actually, I think that's a really great place to start, Your Honor. We certainly think that precluding defenses both on the colloquially stated pay if paid provision and conditions precedent was an error. But even putting that aside for the moment, there were many material disputes of fact that were in dispute, and there was a credibility problem here. In the affidavit or declaration attached to Zitting's motion for summary judgment, there were statements to the effect that Zitting had satisfied all conditions precedent under the subcontract. Then during the 45-day period where discovery was allowed and the deposition of Zitting's 30B6 finally was taken, that deposition showed some really interesting lack of knowledge or confusion as to those conditions precedent. So specifically when Zitting's representative, Mr. Zitting, was asked, have you completed drywall as necessary? I don't know. Were the as-built plans submitted? I don't know. Were the materials submitted, including the releases at the end of a project, which is necessary for retention payment completed? I don't know. And five separate times, Mr. Zitting says during his deposition, I don't know. That was a direct contradiction of the declaration that was attached to summary judgment. So right away, that created a credibility problem that should not have been resolved on summary judgment. Moreover, given the burden.
Can I ask you on that issue, though, wasn't there a certificate of occupancy issued in this? By the time this actually rolled around the summary judgment, wasn't the district court's reasoning and its order is that there's a certificate of occupancy? I mean, that it's built. So where's the issue as far as these conditions precedent? I understand it's a very long litigation because of what had happened procedurally, but by the time the court grants summary judgment, if we were to reverse, what exactly are we? I mean, I'm assuming the drywall is done if they got a certificate from the county.
I think it's important to remember the timeline, Your Honor, because there was a change in general contractors. This went from APCO to CAMCO. So the important evidence as to the drywall is that at the relevant time that we're talking, The photographs, which were also authenticated, showed that the drywall for the buildings in question was not completed. So some of the subsequent events were under a different contractor, and there's a different timeline.
But the contractor, let me ask you something. Okay, but that's the contractor. I mean, there's no evidence to show, is there, that Zittings didn't do what they were supposed to do, even if it went to December, if they did what they were supposed to do and they finished their part in it, what would we reverse for as far as they didn't do something per the contract, per the subcontract with APCO?
There were several material disputes of fact that were still in dispute, and that was in the record in the district court and attached as exhibits on summary judgment. It's not just the completion of the drywall. That was one of the conditions precedent. It's undisputed that there was no payment from the owner on this property, so that's something that needed to be addressed. And in giving just a blanket, you know, just void as a matter of public policy, Judge Denton didn't even reach the factual and legal conclusions that were relevant to that issue. In addition, there still were issues with releases. There was issues with the as-built design plans. And then when it comes to change orders, that's a completely different ball of wax, and there remain questions as to whether the change orders were processed correctly as well.
Well,
so really what it gets into. Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is such an imperfect medium here. If in fact there's all these issues, then why weren't they in the interrogatories, the other interrogatories, the depositions? I mean, it's clear to me that there's frustration evident in this order by Judge Denton, and that was pretty reasonable after the time period, even taking into account that it was stayed or there was a long lag in that. There's a pretty emphatic, we only have one defense that we're pursuing here, and that's this pay of played. So it's kind of like you put it all on black, and then, you know, when that didn't pan out, then the attempts to kind of add the other defenses seemed a little too late. What are your thoughts on that? At least that's how Judge Denton was seeing it.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. Both the affirmative defenses and the entire theory of the case included other defenses. And it's important to remember, too, that what we're dealing with conditions precedent isn't a matter of our burden to show that conditions precedent were not met, but that plaintiff, as a moving party in a breach of contract action, had the burden of proving that they met the conditions precedent. And that's under the CCSD versus Richardson construction case. So it was really a matter of questioning whether one of the essential elements of their claim had been met, which is a completely reasonable thing to do on summary judgment. It also was information that came across during depositions, especially of the 30B6 representative's deposition, Ms. Allen. That information came across. So it's a difference of not only is there the affirmative defense on pay of paid, but then they also just a question of who had the burden of proving the elements of that claim, and that was on Zittings. So it's kind of one of those. Go ahead, Your Honor. I know that there's a little bit of.
I'm sorry, but don't you have an obligation in your in discovery? They say kind of, hey, narrow it down. What are you saying we did wrong? And all we got was we weren't paid. So I mean that's problematic.
It is a problematic issue that comes across, especially when there's a contention interrogatory, and there's a whole reason that those are disfavored. And that there was an objection to such a broad interrogatory asking for all facts, all, you know, evidence that's going to support what the defenses were. But it definitely came through during the deposition of Ms. Allen, which was, you know, even though this has a big gap, you know, when everything else was going on, still fairly early before the time when summary judgment was filed. And when it comes across in a deposition, it's not like there's a mystery. It's not like someone discovered a document. This was a known issue. And frankly, as is stated in Zittings' answer, the information known to the parties was kind of overlapping because of subcontractor and contractor relationship. Things relevant to conditions precedent were known to both parties in that overlap. So when it came to things like completing drywall, which was a provision that Zittings wrote into the subcontract, and when it comes to things like completing the releases and the waivers, that was already known to be a requirement, and that was a known fact for both parties. So this was not the type of situation where it's a surprise or prejudice when they knew or at least should have known as a very element of their claim that that was something that they needed to show. And even aside from all those issues, if we could just briefly touch on the issue under NRS 108239, the district court's decision effectively made a general contractor the guarantor for the owner in this case. And that's inconsistent with the statutory scheme in that a mechanic's lien foreclosure sale is designed to compensate parties, be it a general contractor or subs, who have a mechanic's lien in place. So when the sale of the property does not cover that, the entire point is that there could be a personal judgment or personal, you know, liability for the owner that owned the property previously. It would not make sense to hold a general contractor in the same position, or at least kind of shoulder to shoulder with the owner, because basically they have all the risk if a project collapses and none of the benefit if it's a great success. So that's another problem with the district court's order, is that when we read the statutory language and we read it as a whole, we don't make anything superfluous and we hold it to the context of that statutory scheme. In this case, putting APCO in a position where it had to guarantee the debt that remained was not a correct reading of the statute and also was just unfair. And if that were the type of thing that were okay, this creates really bad issues for general contractors who are already in that squeezed position that this court noted in Lehrer. General contractors already have a lot of risk when they're relying on an owner for payment to pay subs. And now if they're also potentially at risk of having to pay following a foreclosure sale, that's also a big problem. So I see that I'm at 5 minutes, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time unless the court has any other questions.
Okay, you may do so. Thank you very much. Mr. Ramirez, you may proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Jorge Ramirez. I represent the respondent, Zitting Brothers Construction. I appreciate the court's time and hearing these arguments. One of the things that we did not hear from APCO's counsel right now, and we haven't heard from APCO's counsel throughout the district court action, is the application of NRS 6464 through 64.628. The pay of paid conditions in the contract that they submitted are void as against public policy. I think that that's pretty clear from that statute. Once you void those pay and paid conditions, if you look at the subcontract itself, under Section 9.4, which is the termination clause, automatically says that Zitting Brothers gets the funds that it expended to complete its work. There's no dispute that, well, there's no admissible evidence that Zitting Brothers did not complete its work. There's actually NRS 30B6 testimony from APCO's witness, Brian Benson, that he says that all of the work was done and it was done to the satisfaction of the owner. So that's what the district court was analyzing when it rendered summary judgment in this case. It had the framework of the contract itself, where there was an automatic payment once the contract was terminated. APCO has admitted throughout this litigation that it terminated the contract. So that clause kicks in, and APCO should have been paid at that point. If we go to the framework that the Nevada legislature has set out in NRS 64.64 through 628, we'll see that it's the same. The minute that a contractor terminates a contract with a subcontractor, they have a certain period of time to pay them. APCO didn't do that in this case. And any condition in a contract that tries to limit that payment requirement automatically gets taken out. So any condition precedent that they want APCO to, that they want Zitting to meet at this point, gets taken out of the contract. Zitting doesn't have to do that. Zitting only has to establish that it completed the work. Once Zitting establishes that it completed the work under Nevada statutory framework, it has to get paid for that work if the general contractor terminated the contract. That wasn't done in this case. That's what the district court was analyzing. So they didn't need much more than that. All they needed to know was the contract terminated, APCO admits that, and was the work completed. The evidence that APCO tried to show to the district court to undermine that position actually established that the work was completed. because in the documents establishing that not all of the drywall was completed, it also says that the framework was 100% completed. ABCO was only the framer on this contract, the rough framer at that. And in order for the drywall to even start to go up, they had to complete their scope of work. But like I said, those documents from CAMCO that ABCO has presented to the district court show that 100% of the rough framing was done. So if we look at both ABCO's own contract and if you look at the statutory framework, that's all the district court needed to do to grant summary judgment sitting on their contract damages. Now, if the court's going to entertain some of the arguments that were raised in the opening briefs, a lot of those were waived because they weren't raised below. For example, the trial by consent. That wasn't properly raised below because it was only stated in a paragraph. One paragraph, there was no analysis. That's not sufficient, and trial by consent doesn't apply here anyways, because Zitting never agreed to trial by consent. They never agreed to all this. Why? Because early on in this case, ABCO took the position, and I think that it was a tactic that they were taking at the beginning in 2010 when they told Zitting that they were only going to defend this case on the pay-of-pay provisions in their contract. And, you know, back then that kind of made sense, at least in my opinion, because they needed all of the subcontractors to rally around them so that they could go after Scott Financial and try to defeat them on their mechanics lien claim. So they tell the subcontractors, including Zitting, don't keep coming after us. Let's all go after that. And then that's why Zitting agreed to stay discovery. Had Zitting known that they were going to do all of this other nonsense with the conditions precedent, they probably wouldn't have agreed at that point. And they could have taken other steps to make sure that they had the discovery that they needed to defeat those conditions precedents. For example, they could have taken recorded statements during that state period. They could have done all kinds of things to try to minimize the prejudice that now they've suffered 10 years later. The problem, I think, with this case, and the reason that I think that the district court got the case right in striking all of the affirmative defenses, except for the pay-of-paid, is that ABCO from the beginning only wanted to include that claim, and like I said, I think that we know why. If you fast forward then 7 years, when given another opportunity to take that back and say, okay, well, now we're going to defend on all of these other issues, they decided not to do that. Instead, they decided to stick with their pay-of-paid defense. And as we know, that continued to prejudice Zitting. If you fast forward then another couple months when we actually take the deposition of Mr. Benson, the 30B6 witness, on this particular issue, again, they stick with the same defense, the only one. He was given the opportunity to amend the interrogatory answers at that point. He never did. His counsel that was with him at the time, if they truly intended to bring up all of these other defenses, he could have asked them questions about them. He could have tried resurrecting them at that point, but he never did. And then the supplemental that they do 2 months before trial, again, that like the judge said, in the district court, that's too little too late. At that point, we've been prejudiced for, what, at that point it was 7 years? 7 years of never being told, we have all these other defenses that we want to present.
Now, discovery was still open when the supplemental responses came through, correct?
No, sorry, Justice Stiglitz, but that's kind of a misnomer. So discovery was only open to the extent of taking depositions that APLA wanted to take prior to the close of discovery. It wasn't open in full. So there wasn't an ability for Zitting to go ahead and conduct additional discovery. And by then, it's too late anyways, because we were 2 months away from trial. And by then, we had also already filed our motion for summary judgment. All of the briefing had been done by then. So Zitting was extremely prejudiced by the actions of APCO. So there was no abuse of discretion by the district court when it struck the conditions precedent defense that they were trying to now resurrect. And even if you look at the cases cited to try to support their opinion, their decision, those cases themselves, they don't really apply here, because in Richardson Construction, it was the owner against the prime contractor. So there wasn't a real application of 64.64 or 60.628, because those provisions only apply to the prime contractor and the subcontractors. So that's why it's distinguishable.
Mr. Ramirez, why was it proper under 108 to find against APCO where APCO had no ownership interest in the property? Is that what the statute, they talk about public policy. What's your view on that?
Well, 108 allows APCO and Zitting to continue any suit or any claim under that chapter to go after the person or the party responsible for the damage. And I believe that's section 238, subsection 12. And under subsection 12, the party responsible for the damages is the prime contractor, because they're the ones that have the contract. And under NRS 64.64, through 6.4 through 6.28, that makes them responsible for the damages. So when a mechanic's lien, such as the ones in this case, when someone with a higher priority takes all the money and there's a residue, that allows, the 108 allows a subcontractor like Zitting to still continue with the lawsuit and to continue with the lawsuit against the party who owes them, which is the contracted party, the prime contractor. So it isn't that it's unfair, it's the agreement that they wrote. And we have to remember that when contractors, general contractors such as APCO, when they write these contracts, they actually publicize to the world what the limit of their financial burden will be. They have to do that with the contractors board. And the contractor's board, if they don't think that they can meet those obligations, they make them get bonds, contractor bonds. Here, APCO had an unlimited bond. So they were telling the world, they were publicizing to the world, I can write any contract and I can pay it. So they wrote millions of dollars in contracts, and yeah, it's unfortunate that they didn't get paid on the project, but neither did Zitty. And under Nevada's framework, the party that has to bear that burden is the general contractor, because they are supposed to be able to fund any payments to the subcontractors. So I think that the evidence that was presented before the district court, it was sufficient to establish all of the elements that were necessary to grant summary judgment. Because, like I said, it was the very simple factual analysis that they needed, that the district court needed to determine whether the money was owed to Zitting. And upon its conclusion, the money was owed to Zitting. The question about credibility that was raised by APCO earlier, that is part of the problem with this case. That we're taking this deposition 7 years later. And the memories fade. Like the district court said, memories fade. People forget things. Unfortunately, as we've seen recently, people pass away. Companies close. I don't even think that the drywaller that was on this case is even in existence anymore. There's employees at Zing that have passed away since then that worked on this project. If the case gets remanded back, we won't have the benefit of any of that testimony. All because in 2010, APCO made a calculated decision to only stick with the pay-to-pay provision because either they thought that that was a golden defense or because they wanted everybody to rally around them so that they didn't have to deal with two fronts. They didn't have to fight Scott Financial and then at the same time try to fight the subcontractors. As we know now, 10 years later, that didn't pay off for them because the provision that they were relying on, pay-to-pay provision, is void as against Nevada's public policy. Because Nevada's public policy has always been and always will continue to be that subcontractors who pay the laborers, who expend money to pick up material, are to be paid. And whether the general contractors like it or not, they have an obligation under Nevada statutory framework to pay that if the owner doesn't. That's what the Nevada law says. And unless there's any questions, I thank you for your time and I submit.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Ramirez. Ms. Wilde, you have almost 5 minutes left. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to try to hit 4 points, but obviously if the court has any questions, that's the priority. It's very important right out of the gate to note Zitting did not prove that there was no material dispute of fact, especially with regard to the work being done or owner approval. I draw the court's attention to 12 AA 2695, 2751 through 66. That specifically is the deposition of Mr. Zitting stating explicitly that work was not done and that owner approval, I don't know if it was done or not. So that's an important point, especially when you combine that with the answering brief's position that really summary judgment was not granted as a matter of Zitting proving their claim, but that we were denied our ability to present defenses, and that was the main reason the district court completely cut this off and didn't allow it to go to trial. Second important point is to remember that the 7-year timeline is a misnomer. The reply attachment on the very last page is helpful for understanding the context. It is correct that at one point, APCO, Zitting, and a bunch of other subcontractors were more or less aligned going against the bank, and we've already dealt with that issue. While things were stayed, things were stayed. At that point, discovery was not going on because the bigger priority was dealing with the priority dispute as to the bank. So there really was a limited time in this case where this is litigation between APCO and Zitting and then some of the other remaining subcontractors. But another point to recall in that timeline is that the deposition for Zitting's 30B6 representative was delayed several times at their request. So a lot of the alleged delays were not attributable to any bad faith or any issue, but actually a courtesy to getting the deposition taken in a way that worked for Zitting and the council. It's also a key point when we're looking at the language on pay if paid. This is not the case that we're going to suddenly solve all the issues, following Lehrer. But under Padilla versus Big D, we know that there are some cases where pay if paid clauses can be acceptable. The problem here was simply that Judge Denton did not do the work of considering the statutory language or the nature of the subcontract, but simply said right out of the gate, just plain void, and that's it. So while this is not a case to do any kind of rework on the precedent that may have caused some confusion, the proverbial bad facts, bad law, that was a mistake also in that Judge Denton didn't do the necessary work to make that decision. The last real point on NRS 108239, it's important to look at, say, for example, subsection 11. Where there's an overage following a foreclosure, the proceeds go back to the owner. That makes sense. It's the owner's property, and so if there's an overage, they get the return. The entire point of the statute, when you take it in context, is that it's about an owner's sale of property. If it were the case that a general contractor was effectively a guarantor, that creates some really weird questions as to the foreclosure sale. Does a general contractor want to get involved in saying, this price isn't good, maybe we need to look for a better buyer, because they don't want liability? That doesn't add up. yes, general contractors are in a different position in that at times there's the priority, of course, of paying subcontractors, and it depends on the language of a given subcontract. But the meaning of that statute was misconstrued, and at the very least, the district court erred by construing it to make APCO the guarantor for the owner in this case. And this was a bad situation for everybody involved. Like, we don't deny that one bit. When that project collapsed and we were all dealing with the headaches of 2008, this was bad for a lot of people. But now that that whole thing has collapsed and there's no money available, it's not a good situation. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that APCO, as a general contractor, is responsible for every payment to every subcontractor where the preconditions precedent were not met, and where the district court didn't even allow this to proceed to trial for the parties to have a fair day to try the facts that remained in dispute and the credibility issues that remained in dispute. And that's really the key, is the context here is summary judgment. Any facts in question should have been construed in favor of APCO. Credibility determinations should not have been made at that time. There's a big problem with a declaration that directly contradicts deposition testimony. Both are supposed to be sworn and both are supposed to be truthful. So when there's a discrepancy, that in and of itself was a big problem for summary judgment.
Ms. Willey, just to your first point. So absent any of APCO's defenses or evidence, you're saying that Zitting's proffered evidence did not support completion of the precedent obligations?
That's correct, Your Honor. At the very least, that contradiction from the deposition testimony is something that the district court should not have overlooked. And I see that I'm running out of time, but if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Just one. I cut you off. Did you want to wrap?
That would be great. Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, there's a lot here, and there's a lot of different bases upon which the court should reverse and remand. But simply stated, the district court did not hold Zitting to its burdens of proof and made numerous errors of law and including statutory construction problems. So we respectfully submit that this court should reverse and remand.
Justice Silver?
Just as you were wrapping it up, I was going to pose a question. Wouldn't you agree, though, the contract here between Zitting's and APCO, Zitting's was the framer in this, was not responsible for the drywall. Isn't that correct?
I think that's an interesting point because Zitting wrote in the provision that drywall completion would be one of their conditions precedent.
I understand what your argument is, but what I'm saying is they're framers. They're not drywallers. Isn't that true?
I believe that's fair. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very both very much. Excellent arguments and briefing in this case, and we will take this matter under submission at this time. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.